Shrink Wrap Radio number 760, Mark Stern, MD, on Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Adam Stern, MD, speaking about his candid and heartfelt memoir, Committed, Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training, in which he recounts stories from his four-year psychiatry residency at Harvard Medical School. Now, here's the interview.
Dr. Adam Stern, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show and to have this opportunity to talk to you about your delightful memoir, I guess we should call it. Your book about your internship at Harvard. And so it's a pleasure to have you here to discuss that. And you come from a medical family, right?
Yeah, I would say so. My father was a cardiologist, is a cardiologist for the last 40 years or so. And my brother has joined him in those ranks. And before that, a lot of relatives on that side of the family were in medicine. So it was something that I grew up admiring and thinking was a respectable, respected profession that also let you have a comfortable life. So I came to it with a certain notion that medicine and doctors were good, you know, generally speaking.
Yeah. And so did you have any second thoughts about that along the road?
Oh, second, third, fourth, fifth. Yeah, I've had a lot of, I think everyone who goes through the medical school training, residency training and beyond, I think everyone has times where they're not sure that they're on the right path. Yeah. So I think I lost count of the number of times I said, well, if this doesn't work out, what am I going to do next? And so only really looking back now, I'm about 10 years out of training. Is that right? No, I'm about 7 or 8 years out of training, 11 years since I got my MD, I should say. And in that span, you know, I've gained a little bit of humble confidence. You know, there's a humility that I don't know everything. I certainly don't know the right answer all the time, but I'm confident that I can do a good job. As well as the next psychiatrist. So that kind of thing comes with experience.
Yeah, it was hard won. You know, as I read in the book, there were certainly plenty of glimpses of that struggle. And we'll kind of touch on that. So you did medical school before going to the Harvard residency at do you call it SUNY Syracuse?
Right. It was, it's a SUNY school. There are four SUNY medical schools, and this one is in Syracuse, New York. It used to be owned by Syracuse University, and they at some point, I think in the 50s, sold it to the SUNY system. And so it's actually very long and has a storied history, but it's only been known as SUNY Upstate Medical University for a couple of decades, I think.
Yeah. Now, 4 years seems like a long time for an internship. Maybe you can give us an overview of how those 4 years are structured. Maybe there's some listeners out there that are thinking of going to medical school, maybe becoming a psychiatrist. So tell us give us the overview of that journey of what's required.
Sure thing. I'd be delighted. I actually came to think of my life for a period of time. I finally graduated from this thought process. But for a while, I was thinking of my life in these 4-year increments, yeah. Because there was high school, then there was 4 years of college. And that was designed for all kinds of things. But one of those goals was to get into medical school, which I was able to do. And that's another 4 years where you get your MD, you learn how to be a doctor. But really, actually, you don't know how to do the job. You just know the facts, that the foundational knowledge that you need to do the job, to learn how to do the job. So then there's the 4 years of medical school. And then finally, the 4 years of residency. The first of those 4 years we in medicine, we traditionally have referred to as the internship. And that's where even a psychiatrist like myself rotates through internal medicine rotations and wards, things like the ICU, the inpatient services on medicine and neurology, other fields besides just psychiatry.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I was flirting with the idea of going down that route. I was already an undergraduate, I think, at the time. And I thought, no, that's too long, too many years. I ended up going for a PhD in clinical psychology and ended up spending as much or more time.
Right. That's a long road.
On the whole journey. So it was a long road. Yes, indeed. So what was your sense going into that training? What was your sense of yourself, I mean to say, going into that training?
Yeah, you know, I had a sense that I wanted to be a doctor. I knew that from, you know, pretty young age. But I also have this sort of humanistic part of me. And part of that is also the creative part that the book comes from, needing to write, to process my experience, these kinds of things. And so when I was in medical school, looking back, I wanted to do any field that seemed like a traditional medicine kind of field, like internal medicine. And looking back, as I approached the third and fourth years of medical school, I realized really the things that most got me and, you know, got me most inspired to get up and go to the hospital to do the hard work that needed to be done was the brain and behavior courses. It was the rotations in psychiatry. In particular, the outpatient rotation, where I got to know people over a period of months, you know, as opposed to just a couple of hours or a few days, as you might on an inpatient service. And so that's when I decided, you know, I didn't go into medical school wanting to be a psychiatrist, but I think it's the only path where I'll be really happy and will be able to do the best. I'll be able to come closest to achieving my potential as a clinician. So I said, you got to do it, even though you don't really want to, you've got to do it. And I went forward. And then in the training, you know, you realize that in medical school, you really are just given a little glimpse into the field. And then once you're there in training, you have to actually learn how to do the job. And in psychiatry residencies, things are structured in such a way that some of the most intense parts of it are right up at the beginning. So the first and second year, mostly inpatient, which means you're working on locked units where patients aren't allowed to leave because they're considered either a danger to themselves or others, or they're unable to take care of themselves. And it's an enormous, sometimes I write in the book, you know, you're on call. At the time I was 26 years old, first full-time job I'd ever really had. And
yeah.
I'm suddenly in charge of the inpatient unit overnight.
And they throw you into the deep end of the pool.
Exactly.
So to speak. Yeah,
exactly. So it's a lot. And you learn on the job very quickly to manage your own anxieties around doing okay, doing the job and making sure, you know, in the beginning it's mostly like, I hope I don't mess up and I hope that I can get to morning and everybody's still doing okay. And then slowly but surely you realize how much you're learning just by doing and being around other people who are doing well.
Yeah. Well, you struggled with imposter syndrome off and on, certainly in the beginning. That was pretty intense for you. To being thrown into the deep end, and right away you're confronted with some pretty dramatic behavior, and you don't know what to do, and more experienced nurses are there, and they're kind of maybe looking a little askance. Can say a bit more about that, or maybe you remember a story. I think you tell us there are lots of stories in the book, and I'm hoping that you can squeeze as many as you can into this conversation here. Because the book is plenty long, you won't be able to tell them all in our short time together. So tell us about that first impact experience on the locked ward.
Right. So, you know, in the book Committed, I wanted to introduce the reader. I wanted to bring them into the world right away into this sense of feeling overwhelmed by the job. And so the very first scene is a bit of a flash forward. It's a month into residency, and a patient is in a psychotic state on the inpatient service. And they, you know, because of some delusions of paranoia, whatever it might be, they were had crawled on the very tip top of a bureau, and we were trying to gently encourage the patient to come down so that we could have a conversation, so that we could get them out of harm's way. And the patient leaps forward and is caught, you know, by security and given medications to help them relax, for lack of a better phrase. And it's a part of the job that I never, I'm like I said, years into this career now, I still have never quite gotten used to that idea of giving someone medicine, even if they don't want it, because it's what's necessary in the moment. And in that moment, I'm sort of flabbergasted by the whole experience, and I feel terrible for the person being treated. I feel terrible for myself, for the security guards, for everyone, and a nurse. And you alluded to this a little bit, I think, that, you know, a lot of times residents, trainees, they come through and we don't know anything, and then we learn, and then we go off onto the rest of our careers. But we're working in fields, in areas where there's a lot of career nurses, career social workers, career occupational therapists, et cetera, that have seen residents come and go, and they've seen it all, you know, and this incident was nothing major to them. And so the nurse in this scenario said something along the lines of, you know, don't worry, you'll get used to it. And I said, I don't know if I want to get used to it. And she said, well, now that's your stuff getting in the way. And that's how that very first scene sort of comes to a close, because it's a core tenet of the rest of the book is my struggle to come to terms with what the profession is. What it entails, what kind of responsibilities come with this job. And some of them are a privilege, and some of them are a weight that you carry with you.
Yeah. And your book reads like a novel, you know, and and I see you smiling. I guess you're delighted to know that. Maybe that's what you're going for. And it's clear that writing is a passion for you. As a matter of fact, I have the impression this was maybe your third book. Is that right?
This is the first book that is a book of nonfiction memoir. And this is the first book that is with a major publishing house. When I was in college, I wrote a novella, fictional novella. When I was in med school or maybe residency, I wrote a piece of fiction as well, that both of those were essentially self-published. And then a couple of years ago, I actually put out a book of cartoons, a little, really frankly, like doodles that I've done. So again, all three of those prior efforts were self-published, and I liked them all in their own way. But this book was a different ball of wax altogether.
Well, good for you. My hat's off to you. I actually majored in creative writing as an undergraduate, and but I found that I think going into it, I didn't realize that. Well, I didn't have the discipline to be alone that much, and the writer craft is really demands being alone. And you actually got these things out and got the work done. So my hat's off to you.
Thank you. A lot of this book, if I can interject, a lot of this book was written during the height of the pandemic in 2020. And you know, it was a period of time where everybody was working from home as best we could. The kids at that point, we had just the one child actually was at home. You know, daycare was shut down, and it was a wild time in everybody's lives, and a terrible time for a lot of people. But to get the book written, I actually had to I had to make a rule for myself that I had to stick to. And I asked my wife to help me keep myself accountable, which was to write something for about half an hour every day, you know, whether it was good or bad or anything in between. I had to sit down and keep my momentum going, and the book wouldn't have happened.
Good for you. Yeah, that's great. So I'm thinking, you know, because it's written in a novelistic way, a collection of stories, a memoir, it's hard to know just how to guide this interview. But what I'd like to suggest is maybe we can go through the 4 years and you give us the flavor of each of those years and illustrating any stories that are top of mind for you.
Sure.
So year one, going into year one, what were your goals?
My goals in year one, really, it's going to sound cliche, but they were just to get by. You know, I was overwhelmed with this feeling you alluded to earlier, imposter syndrome, feeling like any given moment they're going to find out this was a mistake. Adam Stern doesn't belong here in this program with all these other, you know, talented people. He should be somewhere else, you know. That was my feeling. And so it took some time to overcome that or learn to live with it, you know.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, there's at least one, maybe one and a half chapters in the book devoted to my medicine rotations, where, again, I felt like a fish out of water. I felt like I was, you know, this isn't what I was going to do for the rest of my career. It was something I had to get through without hurting anyone, making sure I was doing a good job, but also just get through it, you know, and learn as much as I can from it and keep going forward. That's one of the themes of the book is keep going forward, and eventually circumstances tend to change when you do that.
Yeah.
So year one is a lot of orientation in the larger sense, you know, getting oriented to this world of hospital medicine, getting to know the very first patients that would call you doctor and rely on you for help when you didn't even know necessarily what the help should be, and learning to get supervision on that, you know, learning how to ask for and learn from the people who have been there before you. That's year one. Year two,
there's a chapter. Oh, let's not go to year two quite yet.
Oh, okay.
Sure. Not ready to move that quickly.
Sure.
First of all, I want to say I really identify with your inner struggle, particularly in that first year. You mentioned that you had a sense of inferiority coming from a SUNY campus compared to other people who were in your program, who I guess were coming from high prestige Ivy League schools. And so there was that self-consciousness. Well, I really identified with that because the same thing happened to me when I was in my doctoral program. And I'd gotten into the doctoral program from from what at the time was called the Montana State University, a master's program. And my first faculty person who I met when I arrived at Michigan said, I didn't know we even read applications from Montana.
Right.
You know, and as I looked around, of course, yes, everybody else seemed like they've come from a really prestige school, from Harvard and Yale and so on. And they seem to have had a burning desire to become a clinical psychologist. I barely had heard of a clinical psychologist. I wasn't sure what it was all about. So that I can really identify with your struggle. I think in the book, in one of the chapters, probably one of the early chapters of the first year, you described a medical case where you kind of had to take a guess at, I guess, on rounds. The senior person would challenge you, okay, what's going on here? And you'd have to come up with some kind of provisional diagnosis. Is there one that comes to mind that was particularly embarrassing where you were way off base?
There was one, I mean, the one that's popping into my head right now is not in the book, but I think just gives you a sense of sometimes how lost a young doctor can feel, especially when sort of challenged, not challenged exactly, but pressed by your seniors. there was a patient experiencing, this is years and years and years ago, when I was an intern doing my medicine rotations, and there was a patient experiencing a degree of seizures. They had epilepsy, but no one knew why they were having the seizures. And essentially, they were constipated, and the medicine that they were taking, which typically would control their seizures, was not making it appropriately through the system. The absorption wasn't happening. And at some point, I had to describe to the attending physician, who's an internal medicine doctor, that the patient had a bowel movement, and so things we think are going to be okay. And the doctor, I just remember, looked at me with the most confused expression, and I hadn't articulated the premise, which the resident had explained to me, that this is why the medicine wasn't being absorbed. And so, you know, the patient moving their bowels is actually a big deal. And now we think the medicine will work better. I hadn't articulated that to the attending, who's like the chief, you know, like, yeah, the head of the right team. And so she looked at me and said, "Constipation causes seizures?" Like I was just the dumbest, you know, least intelligent person in the world. And I'll never forget that moment, but I had to then backtrack and try to explain why I was saying that. And it was the whole thing. I mean, it's years, all these years later, and it just popped into my head when you asked that. So
yeah. I think actually it is in the book, I think.
Oh.
I think it is. I know it's easy to forget what you've written the things I've written, it's like once on the page, out of sight, out of mind. I've moved on. My brain is gone somewhere else.
Right.
So during that first year, what would you say were the biggest challenges?
So there was the most concrete stuff of learning how to do the job and doing it with all of the physical and emotional and mental challenges therein. So, you know, for the first time in my life, I was working 80 plus hours a week. Some of those rotations, it would be like a 30 at this time, you know, in the early 20, in 2010, let's say, when I started out, you could do a 30 hour shift and then go home and sleep in the daytime and then come back and then do another shift and then another 30 hour shift after that. And so it was like the schedule almost made me feel like I was, you know, unable to keep things straight, you know. And immediately after that year, that was the last year that they allowed interns to do 30 hours straight, because it's so obvious that you know it's the equivalent of practicing medicine while, you know, under the influence of something, because you're sleep deprived, you can't think straight. But you also gain some valuable experience that way, because you get to treat the same patients over longer periods of time and see how they progress and see how they respond and that kind of thing. But so that was the physical challenge of literally, you know, for periods of time, not the whole year, but for periods of time, you know, living almost at the hospital and night float. There's an entire chapter in the book about night float where you come on at 6 p.m. and it's you and another resident, and you're basically in charge of psychiatry for the hospital, which is a 600 bed place, you know, unit. Anything that comes up with psychiatric issues, you're in charge of sort of dealing with it, and you can call the attending at home, but, you know, really it's on you to make decisions and to know when to ask for help and what questions you need to ask. So learning those things was a real, real challenge. Night float, going on at 6, getting out at 8 or really more like 10 a.m. the next morning, and then trying to sleep during the day and come back in at night just to have the following week switch back to a daytime schedule. You know, that kind of thing. I watched my classmates go through it, and I would see their physical appearance deteriorate. Their hair would become greasy and their eyes sunken, and, you know, and then I went through it myself, and then other people went through it, and we would try to support each other during those periods because it was just so intense.
Well, that's something that certainly I've been concerned about. I think there's more concern these days because we know so much more about sleep. Sleep research has really pointed to the insanity of having doctors, surgeons in particular, sleep deprived. And has that changed? Is that changing, do you think?
It is changing. There are more every year. It seems like there are more and more rules about and guidelines about necessary rest, you know, periods. The challenge is one of several challenges is that people in the medical field, A, never want to feel like they're complaining. They're do-gooders by nature. They've self-selected to show they'll do what's asked of them. They'll follow orders, that kind of thing. And so you never want to say, hey, I'm too tired to do that, or I can't do this as well as I could have at the beginning of the shift. Can someone step in for me? So that kind of thing is counter to the culture of medicine, which is a problem. But every year they do institute more and more rules about breaks and periods. And so what's happened is there's more shift work where the shifts are briefer. They might be a maximum of 16 hours. But what that does, and that's a good thing for sleep deprivation, but it also has a cost in terms of every time you transition care of someone from one doctor to the next, there's a chance that something, it's like a facsimile that gets photocopied and photocopied, and there's an opportunity for error, for lapses, for information that's not communicated. So it's a difficult problem.
Yeah, shifts of 16 hours, that still sounds like an awful lot to me.
Right. I mean,
did you say 16 or did you say 6?
No, I did say 16. Yeah, I think that's what the interns do now.
Wow.
I think that's the current standard for the maximum that the interns are supposed to be allowed to do.
Yeah, I hope I don't go under the knife with one of those, I'll tell you. So what were the biggest learnings for you in that first year?
I would say the biggest lesson that I came away with was that it's okay to not know the answer to something. Mm-hmm. That sometimes people who have been doing this a lot longer, a lot wiser than you are, don't know the answer. And sitting with that uncertainty is very often the process that leads you to the solution or the outcome that is going to happen. So in other words, you know, you may think I've got to do X, Y, and Z to get this patient better, but I can't do it for some reason because either the patient doesn't go for it or because the system doesn't allow for it or whatever it might be. And sometimes what I learned that first year is you have to roll with it and wait and see how the situation evolves. And often the solution, you know, there's a later chapter in the book called Don't Just Do Something, Sit There, which is something one of my mentors taught me. And I think that is an important lesson.
Yeah, indeed. So let's move on to year two. What were your goals going into year two?
Yeah, so by year two, I was finding myself mentally, emotionally in a tough spot. Because the cumulative effect of exhaustion, also social isolation. You know, I write in the book about how I moved to this new city in Boston without knowing anyone. I had just my pet guinea pig at the time to keep me company. I was close with my classmates, but a lot of them were busy with work and with their own social lives. And so social isolation took a toll. And I think that a lot of medical trainees and psychiatric trainees in particular have a tendency of feeling, you know, holding the emotions of the people that they're working with. And so I liken it to almost like a reflective glass when you're in with a patient where some of what they say gets sent back to them and they can sort of hear what they're putting out to the world, but some of it lands or passes through you and you feel it, you know. And so I think by second year, I was feeling a lot, you know, I was feeling a lot of the desperation that some of the inpatients had, patients in the emergency department, patients that were chronic and not getting better, but either staying the same, you know, they'd get better and get worse, get better and get worse. That pattern became apparent to me, and it's hard not to become disillusioned when you become aware that a lot of mental illness is chronic in nature or episodic. It's going to come and go. And in some cases, it's an at this point in time, it's a downward trajectory over time, you know, so you can still do good work and have a negative outcome happen. That's one of the themes in the book.
Yeah. And maybe you've covered this in what you've just said, but I wanted to ask you, what were the biggest challenges in year two?
Yeah. So year two, I think there's even a chapter title called Like the First Year, But More. And that was it. So I think in the first year, we were pretty much maxed out at covering what we would call carrying four patients, which meant, being in charge of the care of four patients on the inpatient service. And by second year, that was up 50%. You know, we're carrying six or seven patients, and you're more responsible in the emergency setting because it's just you down in what we call the bunker, you know, where we would sort of hole up and try to manage all the various patients that were coming through the ER with psychiatric problems, while also teaching the new PGY1, that's a postgraduate year one, you know, an intern. And so you have more responsibility, more patient volume, but at least in year two, for me personally, the solace was that at least I was doing psychiatry again. I was out of medicine. I was past that. I was out of neurology. I was in the field that I chose. I just wasn't practicing in the environment that I wanted to, in the way that I wanted to yet.
Yeah. So psychiatry, I guess, was maybe still is very biomedically oriented, and also very much administrative, because you're trying to you're running a ward, really, with a lot of administrative responsibilities. What about psychotherapy? Are you getting any training in psychotherapy during this 4 years?
That's a great question. You do get psychotherapy training, at least the basics. I like to say that once you're out in the world, you have to go out of your way to do psychotherapy, because society has incentivized psychiatrists not to do psychotherapy, but to see lots and lots of patients with fewer, you know, minutes per visit and less frequently. And it's a terrible thing that society has sort of gone in that direction. But in training, we do get the basics about therapy, and that starts, you get your very first, what we called integrated therapy case, by which we meant the opportunity to prescribe medications, but also to do weekly insight-oriented psychotherapy. And again, that experience was like learning by doing. There's no, you know, we had the didactics, but you can't really know what to do with a patient until you try to do it with them. You know, even something as simple as how to talk to them in the hallway from the waiting room to the office, you know, that kind of thing will test you and make it stimulate your mind in a really exciting, interesting way, because it was just something that you never knew. One of the things that I think is so fascinating about psychiatry and psychotherapy in particular is that what you say and how you say it and how you listen, they all matter. You know, it matters because it's a give and take with the patient, right?
Yeah.
It's not a prescription for an antibiotic that, you know, goes at the patient and they take it. Psychotherapy is a dynamic, right?
Yeah. And I, you know, you mentioned at the outset that you were very interested, that you had a kind of a personal humanistic orientation, which I think would serve you well in terms of being a psychotherapist, because what we've learned through research on psychotherapy is that the most important aspects of it are the person, the right. Two people, and the degree to which they're able to connect. And you seem to be the kind of guy who understands that and who's been who kind of went into it with that idea.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, 100%, that the therapeutic alliance, so to speak, is it's like 90% of what we do. All the bells and whistles of technique after that are really important, but you know, they lose their impact without a therapeutic alliance at its foundation. So yeah. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. And in the book, you kind of lump years three and four. I think they're in the same section. So tell us about years three and four, what that was about for you, and what challenged you, what you learned.
Yeah, in years 3 and 4, it's almost, there was almost a degree of Ericksonian development that I think about in terms of the progression that a resident takes over those 4 years, because by years 3 and 4, you're a little more comfortable in your own skin, but you're actually starting to think, what do I want out of this career? How do I, you can see the end of your training down the road, mm-hmm. and you know that whatever path you take, it will leave behind countless other paths that you haven't taken. It's the first time in your life, really, that the choices that you make really closes a lot of doors that were open to you right before the choice. I guess that's not entirely true. Choosing to go to medical school, you know, sort of closes some doors and that kind of thing. And going into psychiatry closes some doors. And but in this case, it's like not just for the next 4 years, but for the rest of your career. So in year 3, I really enjoyed working with these integrated psychotherapy patients. I had a bigger caseload at that point. And then I also had what we called a psychopharm clinic, where the patients were primarily meant to be treated with medications. That's why they were coming. But in fact, you know, patients don't read the description. You know, it's such a silly concept that we should expect a patient to know what kind of treatment they're in. They're just coming to see the psychiatrist, right? So in the book, I talk about one patient who came once a month or so to the psychopharm clinic, where the visits were meant to be about medications, but you know, he wouldn't take any medication. And what he got out of it was it was like the only place in the world that he, I think, felt comfortable talking to someone and telling them what was going on with him.
Yeah.
And one of my mentors, supervisors, I was, as a rule follower at that point in my life, I was very uneasy with this idea that I could be just doing not even like formal therapy, but really just sort of like supportive, having a supportive stance with someone for 25 minutes once a month. You know, it didn't feel quite right. And my mentor set me straight and said, you know, this is what this patient needs right now, and you're the guy to do it. You know, it's working. Keep doing it, you know.
Yeah.
And that was a very powerful lesson as well in that third year.
Yeah. And I remember, I guess it's in the fourth year that you you became fascinated with TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, as and that's something I've been very interested in, are these new technologies and so on, as a kind of a reflexive technophile over the years. Mm-hmm. But you struggled with that because, you know, we're always hoping for the magic bullet, and you went into it, I think, with some feeling like, okay, this is the magic bullet. But then what happened?
I think the context is important too, where I had seen ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. I'd seen the power of it earlier in residency training. It's an incredibly effective treatment for some people, where a lot of other things don't work, but it's also very challenging for patients to get. There's a lot of stigma around it, and memory, cognitive difficulties sometimes. And so the idea of TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, was so appealing to me because at its premise, it uses more and more of our knowledge about how the brain functions and then dysfunctions and mental illness to pinpoint, you know, a spot in the brain that if we target it in just the right way, we can activate it. And that might change the way that this network in the brain is functioning and get someone out of their depression, whereas their medications and therapy hadn't been doing it. So that premise really spoke to me, and even more so the idea that it is something that is a tool that's right now, it's just limited by our understanding of psychopathology, where this comes from at the biological level. The more we learn, the more potentially useful this tool could be. That was what drew me in. I felt like I was getting in at the ground floor. You know, that was FDA approved for depression in 2008. This was just a couple of years before my training started. So it was a new technology at that point. Yeah. It had been around the research realm for a while, but as a clinical treatment, it was fairly new. here we are, you know, in the year 2021, and it is still approved for depression. And the progress has been incremental. And then it seems like every year, it seems like maybe the next year or two will be really a tidal wave of change and progress. But it's been slow. It's been, I know the scientists, I have my own scientific research in this area. I know how methodological, what's the word I'm looking for? It's
methodological.
Yeah, I know how it has to be step by step, incremental, so that you don't rush to conclusions. Uh-huh. But at the same time, I see the patients and we're stuck at the same, you know, 50 to 60% response rates we had when I started, you know. And so I can't wait for the day when I, you know, maybe someday you'll let me back on the show and I'll tell you, you know, we got that up to 90% this year, you know. Uh-huh. But so far it hasn't happened.
Yeah. So that's something that you're still interested in and tracking and involved in.
Very much so. Yeah. So some of, you know, half of my time is spent working with patients and the other half is spent doing some biomarker research to try to figure out, is there a way we can predict who's going to respond to this treatment and who's just not going to respond and might respond to a different approach entirely? That way, you know, we're not spinning our wheels and, you know, offering ineffective treatments for that 40 or 50% of the group that's not going to respond to our current approach.
Yeah. Now, right now, one of the bright flashes in the pan is psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, and I've been conducting a number of interviews. I've been fascinated by that. Do you have any impressions one way or the other?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do have thoughts that certainly, I think, evolve over time, but the thing that's always the core values that I have around this is that these naturally occurring substances, things like psilocybin, things like cannabis, these are obviously, they have psychoactive properties. They're changing things at a biological level. My hesitation around them is that, you know, as medical scientists, we owe it to patients to improve upon nature, right? So it's something that I think these things should be studied and then really enhanced for efficacy and safety, those two things together. Yeah. And so I'm all on board. I'm 100%. I think that, you know, one of the worst things to happen to psychiatry is this monoamine hypothesis of mental illness, saying that, you know, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine were like the most important things and really the only things we could, you know, mess around with to improve patients' depression or psychosis. That's such an oversimplification. It's obvious that there things are much more complicated and we have so much to learn from studying nature. But where I draw the line is, for me, I want these things to be rigorously studied and then applied, right? Yeah. And if it turns out that pure psilocybin from the environment, you know, is a great treatment when paired with psychotherapy for PTSD, for example, which there's starting to be evidence for, if that's the best we can do, great. I will be right in line with the training up how to do that and figuring out how to prescribe it. But it's a process. And yeah. And I think it is, I do think, I will just say this, broadening our horizons, opening our minds and research dollars to the idea that there's a lot more out there than we've assumed that might be useful is a good thing.
You ended up staying at Harvard, right? You discovered that you liked teaching,
mm-hmm.
and you also liked having your hand in research, and that by staying at Harvard, as opposed to going into some kind of private practice or large group practice, Harvard would give you more of that, more of the teaching and research opportunities. Are you still at Harvard now?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still here. I have a position at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. At Harvard, they start you as an instructor. And so a few years after that, I got promoted to assistant professor of psychiatry, which I think is where most universities start people out of training. The bottom line is I'm still here. I'm still working. And teaching is a wonderful thing. And I really if it weren't for the opportunities to both be involved in education, but also, like I said, get in on the ground floor of this technology, I probably wouldn't be here. I'd probably be out in private practice, like you said, somewhere where I could define more easily define what the scope of my practice looked like and how many patients I saw and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So who's your ideal reader for this book, and what is it that you hope they'll get out of it?
I think the ideal reader is someone that is interested in mental health as a concept. Maybe they are considering a career within the field, the broad field of mental health care, all the way from psychiatry, all the way to any number of other, areas within psychology, essentially. I like to think that this book tells a story that hasn't been well told before about what it's actually like on the ground to become a psychiatrist from a wide-eyed medical student graduate, med school graduate. You know, I think that more than anything else, this book tells someone, this is what it's like, this is what it's going to take. If this seems really interesting to you, you might really like this field. And the field needs good people. You know, it needs interested, smart, engaged individuals to go into it. And so that's the ideal reader, is someone that's young, interested, maybe considering it. But I hope and I think it has a broader appeal. Part of the appeal that I hope it has is to anyone that's interested in how human beings connect, like you were saying earlier. What's at the core of why these kinds of therapeutic encounters are helpful? There's a love story in there. So anyone who's interested in you know, if you were a fan of Grey's Anatomy, it's a little bit tamer maybe than Grey's Anatomy, but it's there's a heart to this story as well. And so I think that if any of those themes appeal to you, I think that you might get something pretty good out of the book.
Indeed. And I agree. And I think you hit the mark. So Dr. Adam Stern, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
I really appreciate Adam Stern, MD, and the detailed picture he's given us of psychiatric training in his book, Committed: Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. As I mentioned in the interview, this book is a memoir. Reading it is a bit like reading a novel, including the self-revealing interior dialogues. I really appreciate how willing Adam is in this book to share his vulnerabilities and self-doubts. It really takes me back to my own graduate school anxieties. I'd never labeled my experience as, quote, imposter syndrome, but in retrospect, it fits. I lacked the apparent confidence displayed by many of my fellow grad school students who had known for a long time, never doubting that they were destined to become clinical psychologists. The tracks they were on were greased by the fact that they came to the University of Michigan from premier Ivy League universities. So yes, I did feel like an outsider in my initial years in that program. The irony is that more than one of my peers became psychotic or committed suicide. The program Dr. Stern went through sounds every bit as demanding and stressful, if not more so. I wonder if there were any similar casualties. More than anything else, I think getting through a doctoral program requires tenacity. You have to stay the course despite whatever personal demons you struggle with. Do the work. Show up. And keep doing the work and keep showing up. And eventually, you'll get there and realize you had more substance in your kit bag than you thought. I wonder if Adam Stern would agree. I think he might. Certainly, it's clear that his journey through psychiatric residency, while daunting and harrowing at times, ripened him to become the successful author, teacher, and Harvard researcher he is today. as well as the warm and genuine person it was my privilege to experience. I encourage you to vicariously go on the journey with him. The book is Committed, Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training by Adam Stern, MD.
Hello everyone, my name is Mike Hackett and I'm an accredited psychotherapist based in Dublin, Ireland. I'm delighted to mention that I've just become a jumbo contributor to Shrink Wrap Radio. Having really enjoyed the show for over a year now, I've found that Dr. Dave's interviews and his gentle reflections at the end of each has often left me feeling a renewed sense of passion and enthusiasm in my work, a sense of excitement in being part of a wider community of therapists and mental health professionals, and personally enriched by virtue of the themes and ideas presented in the show pertinent to my own development as both a person and a practitioner. I hope my small monthly contribution demonstrates my gratitude to Dr. Dave for his commitment to forging connections in and amongst us all. Should you wish to express your gratitude, I would encourage you to visit the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click the support button to keep Shrink Wrap Radio in our lives for many years to come.
Thank you, Mike Hackett, there in Ireland. You've really stated the case for supporting Shrink Wrap Radio, and I hope others will feel led to follow your fine example. Thanks to all of our regular longtime donors. It warms my heart each time I'm looking at the honor roll on our site, and I feel so supported by you faithful friends. You know who you are. So once again, it's time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks again to Mark Stern, MD, for sharing his stories from his four-year psychiatry residence at Harvard Medical School. Next week, my guests will be Dr. Edward Brodkin, MD, and Ashley Palathra, MA, authors of the best-selling book, Missing Each Other, How to Cultivate Meaningful Connections. Their book is based on cutting-edge neuroscience research and years of clinical work. They take the reader on a wide-ranging and surprising journey through fields as diverse as social neuroscience and autism research, music performance, pro basketball, and Tai Chi. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.